Nearly 2 weeks since Brian Laundry vanished. Is he still on the run? Is he even alive? The FBI scales back its search of the Florida swamp. But might that mean they're zeroing in? And we've got a breaking development. And later, the voice of American sports. But you also know him from news and late night and primetime and a movie here and there. And for some reason, his name keeps popping up in rap songs, too. Bob Costas, Hall of Fame broadcaster, muse to hip hop, and my guest tonight on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield, wherever Brian Laundry is tonight. It is safe to say he is not resting easy. Thousands of agents are hunting for him, even non-agents hunting for him, and right across the country, too. His face is plastered on every TV channel, local or national, and it seems that it is all anyone can talk about, perhaps finding the news these days a little dry. And today there was action back at that sleepy yellow house in Florida, owned by his family. Police swooped in yet again, but this time they took something very little. Something very little that packs a walloping punch. Items containing his DNA. I am joined by News Nation's Brian Enten, who's outside the Laundry home right now, following all of these developments. And Brian, you're finding a breaking development tonight with Dog the Bounty Hunter, who showed up this weekend banging on the door, and now he says he may have a lead.
Yeah, he was here this weekend. We saw him, and now he says he has a lead. He says that Brian Laundry and his parents, and bear with me here because this is all happening within the last couple minutes, were at the Fort DeSoto campground, which is near St. Petersburg. That is about 70 miles from here. I finally just got Dog the Bounty Hunter on the phone. And again, think what you want of Dog the Bounty Hunter, but he says he has proof. He says that there are records from the family going in and out of the campground twice. I'm going to play you a little bit of this phone conversation. Just listen for 1 second, Ashley.
The campground.
You got it.
So we discovered that on the early September, the mother and father have registered to stay at a campground, and we got the name from the 1st to the 3rd. And then and they stayed in campground number 1. The 6th or the 8th of September, they registered again to stay at the campground, and this time they stayed in space 15.
So you hear that, Ash. He goes on, we can play more of the conversation later, but basically he says he has proof that he went into the office, he has the registration paperwork with the Laundry's names on it. Again, the Fort DeSoto campground, which is near St. Petersburg. He says that he has alerted law enforcement, and this is now part of the investigation, Ashley.
So, Brian, let's just go back over those dates, because that is really interesting. He said from the 1st to the 3rd of September, they were in the Fort DeSoto campground for those 2 or 3 days. And then they went back on, what was it, the September 8th, did he say? Did you catch that?
Yeah, 8th to the 9th, I believe, that he said. And again, he says he has all the paperwork that shows this with their names. I asked him if he has video, if there's video at the campground of them going in and out. He says no, but he says, based on the paperwork and the people he spoke to there, that he's sure of this.
So 1st to the 3rd is a Wednesday through a Friday, and then the 8th to the 9th is a Wednesday again, through a Thursday, but that doesn't square up with the neighbors across the street, Brian, who said that they saw them packing up that that brand new camper they said that they'd bought, the camper top that goes on the back of the truck. They said that was on September 11th, and they said that that was with Brian.
Yeah, let's show you just so you can have a visual. There is the camper top right there behind this red truck. But you have to keep in mind with the neighbors across the street, when they did that interview, they were a little wishy-washy about the exact dates. And when they were pressed, when exactly did this happen, the wife basically said, well, we think it may have been a week ago. It might have been a week and a half ago. So I don't think we should go on exactly the timeline that the neighbors gave. They basically just knew that they packed up the camper and went somewhere. They were a little wishy-washy on the dates.
So, Brian, do we know if Dog the Bounty Hunter is meeting with police regarding this new information and the campground records that he says he has? Or do we know if local police have actually gone to the Fort DeSoto campground to do their own investigation and maybe pull surveillance cameras from that front office?
So we know, according to him, just when I talked to him right before your show, literally right before your show, we would have had him on video if we could have, but this happened so quickly. We know that he says he's reached out to the authorities and they're aware. What we don't know, is this something that the FBI already knew? It's possible that they already knew this, that they've already checked it out, and now Dog the Bounty Hunter has found this out. We don't know that yet. I've reached out to the FBI right before we came on to see if we could get a comment from them, to see if we could confirm that they'd been out to the campsite. We haven't gotten a response yet.
Okay, while all of that is happening, what you said about 70 miles away from you in Sarasota area, the Laundrie family, the parents have become, you know, they've been under such scrutiny, Brian, and they're now sort of clapping back. And I want to read the statement that they sent to you about media coverage about them. Bear with me here. It says, and it's from their lawyer. It says, Chris and Roberta Laundrie do not know where Brian is. They are concerned about Brian, and they hope the FBI can locate him. The speculation by the public and some in the press that the parents assisted Brian in leaving the family home or in avoiding arrest on a warrant that was issued after Brian had already been missing for several days is just wrong, they said. Brian, why do you think the Laundries sent this? Because I think it's fair to say if they're holed up and they're not looking for their son and they're not appealing to the public to help find their son, it just sort of seems like he's not really missing.
So the moment that that statement came out this afternoon, the first thing I thought is, why are they sending the statement right at this moment? And a few things that came into my mind. Number one, we know that the Petito family announced they're going to be having a press conference tomorrow afternoon. Is the lawyer somehow trying to get ahead of that? The second thing I thought of, Ashley, is that you had the Blowhorn people out here again today, the protesters, but they weren't just here for a couple of hours. They were here all day from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. with their blowhorns, and they were shouting at the house very loud every hour on the hour. They would do it for 5 minutes. Did that start to just drive the parents insane? Did they call their lawyer and say, you've got to put something out? We don't know.
Well, and maybe call the police. Like, while people might celebrate that that's, you know, upsetting people who have upset the nation, there are neighbors, and that would be very upsetting to the neighbors as well. I don't know if we have any video of that, but I'd love to see some of those people with the blowhorns, you know, marching up and down the street with their signs and with their, you know, we'll see if we can get some of that video up. In the meantime, while we look for that video, Brian, can you also tell me about the raid that the FBI committed, you know, carried out today to get DNA items from the Laundrie home? Like, how did that play out?
Yeah, so that was another surprise. It was actually over the weekend. It was very quiet out here. Nothing going on. All of a sudden, a black SUV comes down the street in this direction, stops right here in front of the driveway. A couple of FBI agents get out, very calmly walk up to the screened-in area right there in front of the house. They don't go in the house. They stand there for about 3 minutes, and then they walk back to the FBI SUV with a small box. It was almost like a large envelope slash small box. We didn't know what was going on. I immediately start texting with the Laundrie family attorney saying, what is going on at the house? He eventually responded that they were here to collect items of Brian's that they thought could help with DNA matching. He would not clarify exactly what those items were. We don't know, was it a toothbrush? Was it some other kind of item? But we know that they came here wanting something to do a DNA match.
Well, I would think all the Kleenexes in his bathroom trash would be long gone by now, because he's been long gone for at least, well, almost 2 weeks as of tomorrow.
I mean, it's been quite a while, but according to the attorney, you know, it's not like there was a warrant or something. That the parents were cooperating, and they did let the FBI come in, and they gave them what they needed.
Right, but those FBI agents were there a week ago bringing out box upon box, and I would have expected the DNA items to be in at that time, not, you know, now 2 weeks after the game. Oh, Brian, darn it. Okay, I get it. We've had lots of bugaboos tonight. Brian Enten doing such an incredible job out there. Okay, we'll try and get him back in a bit. In the meantime, I do want to bring in Andy Gracia. He is the Deputy Chief of Criminal Investigations for the Westchester County, New York District Attorney. He also happens to know a lot about how to track people and how to do it, usually using things that you wouldn't expect you even have. Lots of little digital secrets. Andy, thanks for being here. I'd love you to just bounce off what Brian Enten just mentioned, that the FBI came back today and collected items with DNA. I'm a bit perplexed for two reasons, Andy. One is that it's 2 weeks almost since that guy left. Why now? And two, I mean, DNA, when it comes to Gabby, they were going to be married. They were living in a van together. I would expect lots of DNA to be shared between them and not be very helpful. Where am I wrong?
You know, DNA is always important. They're going to want to collect DNA as soon as possible. If there's defensive wounds possibly on a body or DNA found near a crime scene, they're going to want to match that DNA and see whose DNA that actually is.
So it would make sense if there's his DNA found at the scene where her body is, that they might be able to actually surmise that he sure knew a lot about a dead body, and that would put him in direct contact with a dead body. Whether he created the dead body or not is another issue altogether. But are you suggesting defensive wounds like DNA under her fingernails?
You know, that's always the possibility. Or, you know, is DNA, you know, part of where the crime scene was? Was it left, you know, possibly by something that was there, you know, a piece of clothing or something else, to show that, you know, a specific person was at that kind of crime scene?
Yeah. So moving on from the DNA for a moment, I also want to ask you about, you know, the FBI, when they were there at that Northport, Florida bungalow, they brought out dozens and dozens of boxes. I know that you get that. I mean, I know that you know what it means to execute a warrant, remove items from a house, and do an investigation. What I'd love to drill down on with you is the digital material that they bring out of the house. Not, you know, scrapbooks, notebooks, and those kinds of things, but the electronics and what the digital footprint can tell us. I've always known about the laptop. I've always known about the simple stuff. But there are things that are new, like tile finders for your keychain. Those tell a huge story, don't they?
Yeah, any digital device is going to give specific information. It may tell you the device that it came from, or, you know, give you dating of when that device made a handshake with another device. So, you know, when we're talking about a tile device or we're talking about a router, you know, that handshake between those two devices may be able to say, hey, this phone was in this specific area. Or, and if that phone is related to a specific person, you may make the assumption that that person was at that time in that same location.
Well, it's incredible, especially since we all think we know how to turn our devices off. Those are just a few of the digital devices that could help in this manhunt. But when we come back, you're going to be surprised at what Andy's going to tell you about how turning your devices off really doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot because of the things that you've done, the items that you've checked, okay, thinking it's no big deal. When we come back, it is a safe bet that Brian Laundrie has no idea how many digital clues he's left behind and how those clues could allow Gabby to speak from the grave. And also still ahead, Bob Costas shows and tells, and the rest of us feel like we are there. The icon himself is going to be here, and there he is in all his glory on the big board. Bob Costas joining us later in the hour. Welcome back to our special coverage of the manhunt for Gabby Petito's fiancé, Brian Laundrie. I am joined by Andy Gracia. He is the Deputy Chief of Criminal Investigations for the Westchester County, New York District Attorney's Office. Andy, in every movie and TV show, we see the bad guy turn off his phone and go off the grid. And that really is not the real way it happens, is it? You're not off the grid if you turn off your GPS.
You know, turning off your phone does help to possibly mask, you know, where you are. But is that device, did that device, you know, connect to another device? Did that device, add to the cloud storage? All those things can be looked at and checked out to see, you know, are you leaving a footprint somewhere else? A lot of times your phone is synced to multiple devices in your house. So, you know, an individual throws out their phone, but meanwhile, their smart TV is storing the same data that the phone possibly had on it, or the cloud's backup has that same data. So, you know, it all comes down to, again, looking at that digital fingerprint from a multitude of different ways.
The other thing is, like, every time we sign up for an app because we want to, you know, age our face or do something silly or fun or useful, there's that big, long litany of stuff we're supposed to read and then say, I agree. And somewhere in there, it could say, and would you mind if we keep your GPS on even when you shut it off your phone? You can be tracked by the apps that you buy, right? Like, the apps you sign up for could come back to haunt you.
Yeah, you know, third-party apps will capture a tremendous amount of your data, possibly where you were, where you went, what time you were there. Did you, you know, use a Cash App? You know, just using the Cash App will possibly tell us where you were, how much you got, and when you did that. So, you know, whatever app you're using is also feeding data back to a system that is possibly law enforcement friendly that we can contact and get information from.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk online, and I know that a lot of our viewers right now are probably saying, Ashley, he doesn't have a phone. He said that on the body cam when he was caught, you know, after hitting Gabby and slapping Gabby and Moab. And the truth is, there is still, like, the jury's still out as to whether he had a phone or not, because if he didn't have a phone in you in Moab, somehow his parents said he left his phone behind. So we're not entirely sure what the story is about his phone, but there's some thoughts he might have actually had a phone in some of these shots as well. So the truth is, maybe he's got another phone. But if you purchase a phone and it's not the same phone you had before, you can still track. I mean, you can go back through purchases and then find out about that IP and figure out if he's hooked up to a Wi-Fi somewhere. You can also find some of his commercial data. We've all had the 20% off as we're walking by Dunkin'. It's because they know who you are and where you are because of your commercial behavior, correct?
Yeah, that's one way. If he, just because someone drops a phone and takes another phone on, if they log into any of their email accounts or their Facebook accounts or their Instagram accounts, that's an IP that's going to be tracked. It's going to log itself into the system. And again, that's all accessible to law enforcement through the appropriate means with a subpoena or possibly a search warrant.
So then what about the car GPS part of it, too? Because some people think you can just turn the GPS off on your car and then it won't track you. It's again, not necessarily true, right?
Yeah, it all comes down to the make and model of the car and what kind of entertainment system you have in that car. But if that entertainment system does have a GPS as a part of the car, even though the GPS might not be programmed, it may still contain waypoints that, again, the car could be analyzed, the digital evidence from it, and you would be able to track possibly someone's whereabouts or where someone came from or went to.
All of these I think of as not only ways to maybe help track this guy on the run, but also these are alibi busters. If you tell a story to the police eventually when you're caught and then your digital footprint does not match your brand new footprints, they're alibi busters. So it's all like, it's all very, I don't know, satisfying to think that there are ways that we could be catching this guy that he doesn't even know. Andy Gracia, thank you. Really appreciate your expertise and the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Andy Gracia joining us from Westchester County DA's office. Still to come, that young woman in that van and the woman who's taking these pictures of the man she loves, she is dead. And the man driving her car refused to speak to the police and then just went AWOL himself. Why is that, just that, not enough to charge him with something more serious than bank fraud? And another big question, why are some of the police who investigated him now themselves being investigated? We've got answers for you next. Welcome back to Banfield. A strange new twist in the Gabby Petito investigation. Police officers who once investigated the couple's relationship are now currently being investigated themselves. It is all because of that August 12th incident The now infamous 911 call from a witness reporting that Brian Laundrie was hitting and slapping Gabby Petito in the street.
We drove by and the gentleman was slapping the girl.
He was slapping her?
Yes, and then we stopped. They ran up and down the sidewalk. He proceeded to hit her, hopped in the car, and they drove off.
Okay, you said it's a white van?
White van, I give you the license, but if you give me one sec.
Very clearly, that witness says that the man was hitting the woman, not the other way around. But when the police pulled over Brian and Gabby, the incident report showed that Gabby was the suspect and Brian was the victim. So why so different? That is what the city of Moab is now trying to figure out. Now, listen, let's play the devil's advocate for a minute here. Don't just go pitchfork nation all over those police officers, because it is quite possible that there were two different locations here and two different police units involved in this incident. Location number one is the Moonflower Co-op. That is where the fight started. And that's where the responding officer was dispatched to talk to that caller, that 911 caller who saw it happen there. The second location was the side of the road where the body cams pick up the action, where different officers were dispatched to catch up with Brian and Gabby's moving van. It is entirely possible that only the officers who responded to location one, where the witness was, knew what was reported on the 911 call. But we do not know if these officers responding to location two, the moving van, heard that same information as well. And when we called today to the Moab Police Department and asked that question, we got an answer. And the answer was no comment. Not helpful, but it is an investigation. So we should know, hopefully at some point soon. To help clear all of this up, I'm joined by Stacey Honowitz. She is the Assistant State Attorney for Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit in Florida's 17th Judicial Circuit. I'm going to get to that in 1 minute, okay? But Stacey, since I've got you and I know you know all of the details that are involved in this case, everybody who's talking about this case can't figure out why it's not being called a murder, because it sure stinks like one, and why, with all of the things that Brian Laundrie has done and then AmScrade, he's not already charged with murder. Why is that?
Well, listen, just because he's not charged now doesn't mean that they're not going to charge him. They're trying to do a fast and thorough investigation. Right now, the only evidence that they have with regard to a homicide, although it looks like he's responsible for the homicide, is the fact that he was using her bank card. Now, we all know that in criminal cases, the state has to prove it beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt. There cannot be a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And in this case, you have to look at everything. What if he at some point says, listen, we had a fight. Everyone saw on that other video that we've had fights and spats, and she took off and she left and she never came back. And I thought when I came home, I was going to be held responsible. So I've taken off. Now, does that sound far-fetched? Well, of course it does with everything that we've been seeing. But is there a reasonable hypothesis that that could have happened? Yes. So what the police are doing right now is they are talking to the witness that saw the car. They're talking to the two people that picked Brian up. They are gathering the DNA. They're looking to see if this is a homicide. And they're going to try to put it all together. And with his actions afterwards, can it be a circumstantial case? Absolutely, that they could charge him with murder. Just not right now. They don't want to jump the gun till they have everything.
Yeah, okay, so back to the thing that I was talking about off the top, that the internet's going wild over these police saying, you really screwed up here, and this young woman's dead now. You could have arrested him there, but let's be very clear about how these things work. When those responding police officers talked to Gabby, she admitted and said, I'm the aggressor. I slapped him. Then they looked over at Brian, and they saw actual injuries. So let's be careful not to indict, you know, responding police to a domestic too quickly, right? It's really hard to make heads or tail of it. These people who responded might have thought that the witness got it backwards, given that this young woman, you know, took the blame and admitted it herself. And Brian didn't say anything about doing any hitting. I get it. Women can be controlled. But isn't that really tricky business for the cops on the scene?
I want to tell you something, Ashley. Domestic violence cases are one of the toughest cases to be involved in, because we know, and I know in doing these cases for so many years, you could have an incident that takes place, and when the police arrive on the scene, the victim of that domestic violence, because she's fearful of what could happen later on, will tell the police that nothing happened to them. And in this case, that's what we saw. Now, we've got to figure out who's telling the truth, where, what happened. They weren't present. All they know is when they separated them and when they spoke to her, she said that she was the aggressor. And so what do you do in a situation like that? That's why these officers need to be trained so intently on domestic violence cases, on what domestic violence looks like, on what a victim can actually be saying to you without saying it. And in this case, we've got a firsthand window look into what this relationship was like. And if, in fact, she was just kind of covering up because she was nervous, because she was controlled by him and she was afraid of what was going to go on later. So that's what is going to be investigated now. What happened? Yeah. What did the police officers know? And basically, it's a credibility issue. Did they think at that point that she was in danger because she told them she wasn't?
Right. And then there's also the notion, and I think people are, you know, jumping to the gun to say, just arrest him and take him in and charge him. But the problem is with so many of these, honestly, I hate to even say this, but it's almost the majority of them. The other person will not testify and those charges will go away. So it is a really sticky wicket that they're in. I got to ask you really quickly before I let you go, Stacey. Stephen Bertolino, who's the attorney for the Laundrie family, he released this statement last week that just did not sit right with me. It's about the warrant. He was really angry about how the press was reacting to the arrest warrant for bank fraud. And he said, it's related to activities occurring after the death of Gabby Petito and not related to her actual demise. First thing we all thought was, how does he know when Gabby Petito died? Did that stand out to you, that statement?
Yeah, I mean, listen, he's representing them. He has to put forth something. And when everybody is all over him saying, where is this warrant for homicide? Why is it only related to this? He has to, you know, I don't know why he made that comment, because it is odd not knowing the timing of her death. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see what comes out in the press conference tomorrow. So.
None of us knows when she died. The police haven't released it. The coroner hasn't released it. So I'm surprised that the lawyer for the Laundrie seems to know exactly when she died, unless someone told him.
You're going to see every single night or every, you know, you're going to be talking about it because things are going to flow. They went in, they got the DNA, they want to get a profile. They maybe found something at the crime scene that we are not privy to right now. But the facts are going to start moving and we're going to see the investigation tighten.
Stacey, you're going to have to come back. Thank you, as always. I love talking to you.
Thanks, Ashley. Have a good night.
Stacey Honowitz with us tonight. After the break, he is back on the record. But when wasn't he? Bob Costas joins me live on his HBO series and the sports stories now that are making headlines and not highlight reels. If at any time in the past 40 years that you have sat and watched TV and watched somebody throw a ball or a punch or sink a putt or race a car or a horse or shoot a puck or win a medal, then you know this voice and this face.
Hi, everybody. Bob Costas along with Marv Albert. First item of business, Kirk Gibson will not play for the Dodgers. Jordan, open.
That may have been the last shot Michael Jordan will ever take in the NBA.
A pop in the shadow left. The New York Yankees, world champions, team of the decade, most successful franchise of the century.
A lot of people have begun to say it was simply impossible. Turns out, not quite impossible. Just so difficult, so unlikely, so rare, so stupendous an achievement that we won't soon forget what we witnessed today at Belmont Park.
That triple crown moment in 2018 was a fitting cap to Bob Costas's decades-long relationship with NBC, during which he also covered a dozen Olympic Games and won, 28 Emmy Awards? 28 Emmy Awards, not a typo. Quick, name somebody else who has won Emmys in all of these categories. Sports, news, and entertainment. You cannot, because he's like an EGOT, but in Emmy land. He's in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and when can you get there with a slider like this? Wait for it. Hold on. You got to be something pretty special. That was actually a do-over pitch, so we're not going to talk about the first one, but look at that smile. Bob Costas has a brand new show. It's called Back on the Record. It's on HBO. Thoughtful conversations with sporting legends, and I'm thrilled to have a thoughtful conversation with a sporting legend himself, Bob Costas. You know, I got to be honest with you, Bob. We've known each other for 20 years. We worked in Sydney during the Olympics together with NBC. Mm-hmm. I am not a sports fan, but how is it that I'm a Bob Costas fan? Because you're all sports, so I'll watch sports when you're doing it, but I won't otherwise. What is it about you that makes people like stuff they don't like?
You know, it's one of the most gratifying things you can hear when you do sports on a national level and you're bringing in avid fans, but also casual fans, and big events like the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NBA Finals, the Olympics, where people who don't follow it closely become part of the audience. And then you hear from people, men and women both. I've heard this many, many times. I'm not that big a sports fan, but for whatever reason, they enjoy me. I guess maybe it's the storytelling aspect of it. You know, I certainly hope I get the nuts and bolts correct and that I appeal to people that follow it very closely. But I do try to broaden it out when speaking to a national audience and try and give them a reason beyond the statistics or beyond the minutia of it to care about it.
Well, and now you've got this venue, Back on the Record, sort of, it's Bob Costas mm-hmm. Redux on HBO, where you get to really dig down. You're not doing the speed coverage. You're getting really, you know, thoughtful conversations in with these very, I mean, super extraordinary athletes, and you've had a lot of really big ones too. I'm just sort of looking at the list. So, is this? Do you prefer this? Do you prefer being able to slow it all down and think it all through, and do something maybe once a month, and jumping on the road and covering every game and following it live?
Yeah. Well, at this stage, after some 40 years at NBC, wonderful years, very appreciative of it, but at this stage, I think it's ideal for me to be doing this type of program on HBO. They're synonymous with quality. They give you all the time you need to do whatever it is you do best. And I still do a handful of baseball games. I'll be involved in the postseason in various ways. And that's about all that CNN calls upon me occasionally when sports kind of crosses over into the news sector. And that's about enough for me. You know, people have asked, do you want to retire? No, I don't want to retire. But I want to cut way back from all the things I used to do. I'm very glad I did all those things. But I began to feel several years ago as if it was time to transition into something a bit different. And this is perfect for me.
It's funny that you say people ask me when I'm going to retire. I was going to ask you, how many people ask you, like, when are you going to turn 40?
Oh, yeah, right. Well,
you do have that,
you know, when
charm.
I started at... When I started at NBC, I was 27 years old, and the late Don Olmeyer, who was a legendary figure in television, first in sports and then ran all of NBC Entertainment during the heyday of must-see Thursday nights, you know, Jerry Seinfeld and ER and all the rest. So he was a titan of the industry, and he called me into his office after I'd been at NBC Sports for about 3 months. And he said, you know, we think you have a future here. You're a bright young guy. Let me ask you something. How old are you? And I said, I'm 27. And he said, damn it, with another word in front of the damn it. Damn it, you look like you're 14. How much older do you think you would look if you grew a beard? And he was serious. And I said, 5 years, easy. And he perked up. He said, 5 years, really? I said, yeah, because that's how long it would take to grow it. So I don't know if I've outgrown it or not, but what are you going to do?
14. I mean, to me, anyway. Hey, let's talk a little bit of sports news, because I like the newsy parts of sports. And I was sort of piqued by the idea of a guy named Kyrie Irving. Forgive me, I didn't know him beforehand. I know all the people watching probably know he's a big deal with the Brooklyn Nets. What I thought was interesting about him was that he's following this conspiracy theorist on Instagram that thinks there are secret societies implanting things in you with vaccines that are going to, you know, put you into a plan of Satan. He's refusing the vaccine. Yeah. He is not the only one. And it seems like a lot of these big stars are getting their way in certain areas of the NBA, whereas the janitors and the ticket takers and the masseuses and all and the drivers, they all have to be vaccinated and they all have to wear masks. Why are these guys being able to push people around when it comes to something so serious?
Well, before I answer that in the big picture, to Kyrie Irving, this is also a guy, he is one of the best players in the league, but he's also a guy who previously has said that he believes the earth is flat. It's also scary that he's a vice president on the executive committee of the players union. And specifically, as insidious as this stupid conspiracy theory is that he has followed and liked on Instagram, the idea is that the vaccine is connected to some sort of master computer whose purpose it is to work against the interests of black people and in the interests of Satan. So it's particularly insidious, and that a guy like that believes it is troubling. There's a report out now that the NBA, which is around 90% vaccinated, but that leaves 50 to 60 players in the league who are unvaccinated at last report, and some of them are significant names, that the NBA may ask LeBron James and others, some of the biggest names, to do PSAs, which not only might help put them closer to 100% within the league, but also might have an influence on whatever portion of NBA fans remain unvaccinated, and there is still a troubling portion.
Okay, so Bob, when we come back after the break, I have questions about why you are sort of a rap icon, because I never saw you as a rap icon, but you are a rap icon.
I questioned that myself.
I bet you did. And then I also want to ask you a little bit about all this incredible coverage of the female U.S. Olympic gymnast on Capitol Hill talking about their mental health, especially in light of the sexual assaults that they endured for years and the significance that their testimony has taken on with regard to other athletes and the importance of mental health in sports. So when we come back, we're going to cover all that ground with Bob Costas. And then also a quick programming note, Bob is a big old deal, and so is the guy on that board right there. I want you to make sure you tune in tomorrow night. My guest is going to be one of the universe's favorite astrophysicists. No, I'm going to go there. It is the universe's most favorite astrophysicist. It's Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's coming up tomorrow, and I'm right back with Bob Costas.
I'd be rolling torpedoes, get blunted with Rostis, and for a hefty fee, I'm on your record, like Bob Costas.
That is my guest channeling his inner Ludacris on the MLB Network, where he generally sticks to calling balls and strikes. But there you were, Bob Costas, doing your can I just say super white rap?
Well, yeah, I purposely did it in sort of a newscastery way because I knew it would be even more ridiculous if expressed that way. And I'm told that it's one of about a half dozen different times that I've been name checked in hip hop songs, but it's definitely the most prominent one from Ludacris. My then 15, I guess it goes back 20 years because he's 35 years old now, but my then, I guess, 15-year-old son comes racing into the living room and says, "Dad, Ludacris name checked you." And my first question is, who's Ludacris? And then I was properly brought up to speed. And
but since crossed, so lucky. Your kid thought
crossed paths
for that instant.
For that instant. Yeah. It's like, hey, you know I'm the host of the Olympics. You know your dad is the host of the Olympics. But the Ludacris thing was perhaps more impressive. Yep. And I've since crossed paths with Ludacris, and he's good with all of it. He finds it amusing, and so do I.
Oh, I love it. Okay, let's talk about the this. It's just been such a big sports and news story, how the female gymnasts appeared on Capitol Hill and talked about how critical mental health is in sport. And Simone Biles, when she withdrew from several events at the Olympics, there were lots of people who criticized her. There were loads more people who supported her. There's two issues at stake here. The big one is that these are leaders who are now telling the public it's okay not to be okay, which I think is phenomenal. It's also like when you're a gymnast, it's not okay if you are struggling and you, it's not like you're going to lose by a meter. You could really be injured badly.
Yeah. There's a dynamic there that's called the twisties, where you're up in the air and there's a disconnect between your mind and body, a connection that's been formed over years and years of training and intricate, and if they're not done properly, potentially dangerous maneuvers. Now, what caused that in Simone Biles' case is up to speculation, but I think it's reasonable to assume it's a combination of factors, stress among them. She was positioned as the face, the American face of the Olympics, something she bought into willingly. We're not saying that that's a burden, or it didn't appear to be until it got to be too much. Maybe the expectations that if she didn't perform to perfection, which had pretty much been her norm leading up to the Olympics, maybe that got to her, combination of things, fatigue, whatever it might be. But it wasn't just, despite what some of the ignorant criticism was, it wasn't just that she found the pressure to be too much. The pressure contributed to this situation where she could no longer be sure that she could execute the maneuvers, forget about to getting the scores she was used to getting, but execute the maneuvers without some sort of serious injury. You're up in the air, you could land on your head, paralysis or anything in between is possible, and that is what caused her hesitation and her and caused her to drop out of most of the competitions at the Olympics, even though she realized that it was greatly disappointing, not just to her and to her teammates, but to millions of Americans who really enjoy watching her perform because she was a supreme artist in her particular discipline.
I also like the fact that she said, you know what, your mental health is really important. So even if it is difficult for your environment to pay attention to it, You have to. I only have like 40 seconds left, but I have got to ask you the table for two question that I ask my favorite guests. If we put you at a table and across from you, the seat is empty and you can put anyone in the seat, living or dead, who would you choose at your table for two, Bob Costas?
You know, I can think of dozens and dozens, but I'm lucky enough to say that any great sports figure, past or present, if they were around in the 1980s on, chances are I crossed paths with them and got to know them. I was talking about the late Muhammad Ali with Ken Burns and Muhammad's daughter Rashida on HBO just on the last program we did a few days ago. I knew Muhammad Ali. The one towering sports figure, obviously Babe Ruth and others are before my time, but one who I could have crossed paths with had he not died young was Jackie Robinson. He was only 53 when he passed away in 1972. Otherwise, I'm sure that I would have gotten to know him, and I had great regard for him based on the history and whatnot. A very significant figure, not just in baseball or in sports, but in American history.
We're flat out of time. I love you to pieces. Thank you, Bob Costas.
Bye.
Bye.